This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Thank you, Dennis, and welcome and hello to everyone. As I've been thinking about Abigail and John Adams today, I've been wondering how they would feel about having their private letters read aloud by people they never knew and in a public setting. I'm certain they would approve the venue. It was here, of course, that Bostonians gathered in the years before the Revolution to condemn the British and to listen to speeches urging independence. But what about the people who will read their letters? I'm sure John would have been very pleased by the distinguished men who will be taking his part this evening. I know he's scowling there, but he doesn't mean it. And by the end of the evening, he will smile. Each of these men has devoted his professional life to public service, as John Adams did. He might have envied Senator Kennedy's re-election record, but he definitely would have admired the senator's consistent willingness to speak out on difficult issues and to challenge the opposition, something John did in spades. That's something John did plentifully. Adams would have been astonished by Governor Patrick's remarkable grassroots political campaign that brought him to the corner office of the State House just about this time last year, wasn't it? They didn't hold elections like that when he was running for office. On the other hand, I think John would be quite content to have Duval govern under the Constitution written by John Adams and adopted by the Commonwealth in 1780. And I know that he would have admired Governor Dukakis, not only for the administrative and political skills that helped Massachusetts emerge from one of its worst ever economic and financial crises, but also, and maybe more, for his decision upon retiring from politics to enter academia, to teach young men and women the importance of government and politics. This was one of the cardinal endeavors that John Adams held very dear. As for the ladies, Vicki Kennedy, Diane Patrick, and Kitty Dukakis, would Abigail like to have her letters read by them? Of course she would. They are the personification of her fervent desire that women should take part in public life. Each has had a splendid career, lawyers, fundraisers, and authors. Each has taken a powerful role speaking out for the causes she believes in, especially for prevention of handgun violence. That's Vicki. The issue swirling around domestic violence. Diane. And the multiple needs in the area of mental health. And I suspect for Abigail, each is a strong advocate on behalf of her husband's career, as Abigail most definitely was too. So I think all is well. And I'm happy to turn over the mic to our moderator, Mary Richardson, Now, John and Abigail never tuned in to the evening news on Channel 5. But had they done so, I'm sure they would have applauded such an intelligent and eloquent commentator, enlightening the public about the day's events. Mary?
John Adams, a 24-year-old lawyer in Braintree, now Quincy, probably met the teenager Abigail Smith for the first time in the summer of 1759. He was unimpressed. Not fond, not frank, not candid was the overall assessment in his diary. What changed between them and when, we don't really know, but by the time of their first letter, something certainly had.
Braintree, October 4, 1762. Miss Adorable. By the same token that the bearer hereof sat up with you last night, I hereby order you to give him as many kisses and as many hours of your company after 9 o'clock as he shall please to demand, and charge them to my account. I presume I have good right to draw upon you for the kisses, as I have given 2 or 3 millions at least when one has been received, and of consequence the account between us is immensely in favor of yours.
Thus begins the correspondence of a remarkable American couple that spans some 40 years and over 1,100 surviving letters. No doubt more were written, but we can only guess how many were captured by the British, sunk in shipwrecks, or even simply lost by later generations. What remains tells the story of a revolution, a new nation, a new government, of the fears of war and the burdens of leadership. It is also the story of a marriage of two people, soulmates, who endure years of separation and trial, but never forsake their love or commitment to one another. They married in October 1764, and over the next 8 years had 5 children together: Nabby, John Quincy, the future 6th President of the United States, Susanna, Charles, and Thomas Boylston, though Susanna died in infancy. Now, having become a steady family man, John built a successful legal career and developed a reputation as a political leader. John's appointment to the First Continental Congress in 1774 moved him onto the national stage, a position he relished, even as he found the work burdensome. Abigail, too, took pride in John's accomplishments, but lamented the lengthy separation.
Braintree, August 19th, 1774. The great distance between us makes the time appear very long to me. It seems already a month since you left me. The great anxiety I feel for my country, for you, and for our family renders the day tedious and the night unpleasant. The rocks and quicksands appear upon every side. What course you can or will take is all wrapped in the bosom of futurity. Uncertainty and expectation leave the mind great scope. Did ever any kingdom or state regain their liberty, and once it was invaded without bloodshed? I cannot think of it without horror. I want much to hear from you. I long impatiently to have you upon the stage of action. The 1st of September, or the month of September, perhaps, may be of as much importance to Great Britain as the Ides of March were to Caesar. I wish you every public as well as private blessing, and that wisdom which is profitable both for instruction and edification to conduct you in this difficult day. The little flock remember Papa and kindly wish to see him.
Philadelphia, October 9, 1774. My dear, I am wearied to death with the life I lead. The business of the Congress is tedious beyond expression. This assembly is like no other that ever existed. Every man in it is a great man, an orator, a critic, a statesman, and therefore every man upon every question must show his oratory, his criticism, and his political abilities. The consequence of this is that business is drawn and spun out to an immeasurable length. I believe, if it was moved and seconded, that we should come to a resolution that 3 and 2 make 5. We should be entertained with logic and rhetoric, law, history, politics, and mathematics concerning the subject for 2 whole days. And then we should pass the resolution unanimously in the affirmative.
By June 1775, John was sitting with the Second Continental Congress, and the war had become an immediate presence in Abigail's life. She watched the Battle of Bunker Hill with her son John Quincy from the top of Penn's Hill in Braintree. While the British were technically victorious, they suffered large numbers of casualties trying to secure their position, far more than the Continental Army, though the Adams's close friend, Dr. Joseph Warren, was one of the Americans who perished.
Philadelphia, June 17, 1775. I have found this Congress like the last. When we first came together, I found a strong jealousy of us from New England and Massachusetts in particular. Suspicions were entertained of designs of independency, an American republic, Presbyterian principles, and 20 other things. Our sentiments were heard in Congress with great caution and seemed to make but little impression. But the longer we sat, the more clearly they saw the necessity of pursuing vigorous measures. It has been so now. Every day we sit, the more we are convinced that the designs against us are hostile and sanguinary, and that nothing but fortitude, vigor, and perseverance can save us. It is long since I heard from you. I fear you have been kept in continual alarms. My duty and love to all, my dear Nabby, Johnny, Charlie, and Tommy, come here and kiss me.
Braintree, June 18, 1775. Dearest friend, the day, perhaps the decisive day, is come on which the fate of America depends. My bursting heart must find vent at my pen. I have just heard that our dear friend Dr. Warren is no more, but fell gloriously fighting for his country, saying better to die honorably in the field than ignominiously hang upon the gallows. Great is our loss. He has distinguished himself in every engagement by his courage and fortitude, by animating the soldiers and leading them on by his own example. A particular account of these dreadful, but I hope, glorious days will be transmitted to you, no doubt, in the exactest manner. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, but the God of Israel is he that giveth strength and power unto his people. Charlestown is laid in ashes. The battle began upon our entrenchments upon Bunker's Hill, a Saturday morning about 3 o'clock, and has not yet ceased, and it is now 3 o'clock Sabbath afternoon. 'Tis expected they will come out over the neck tonight, and a dreadful battle must ensue. Almighty God, cover the heads of our countrymen and be a shield to our dear friends. How many have fallen, we know not. The constant roar of the cannon is so distressing that we cannot eat, drink, or sleep. May we be supported and sustained in the dreadful conflict. I shall tarry here till it is safe, thought unsafe by my friends, and then I have secured myself a retreat at your brother's, who has kindly offered me part of his house. I cannot compose myself to write any further at present. I will add more as I hear further.
Philadelphia, July 7, 1775. My dear, the account you give me of the numbers slain on the side of our enemies is affecting to humanity, although it is a glorious proof of the bravery of our worthy countrymen. Considering all the disadvantages under which they fought, they really exhibited prodigies of valor. Your description of the distresses of the worthy inhabitants of Boston and the other seaport towns is enough to melt a heart of stone. Our consolation must be this, my dear, that cities may be rebuilt and a people reduced to poverty may acquire fresh property. But a constitution of government once changed from freedom can never be restored. Liberty once lost is lost forever. When the people once surrender their share in the legislature and their right of defending the limitations upon the government and of resisting every encroachment upon them, they can never regain it. It gives me more pleasure than I can express to learn that you sustain with so much fortitude the shocks and terrors of the times. You are really brave, my dear. You are a heroine. And you have reason to be. For the worst that can happen can do you no harm. A soul as pure, as benevolent, as virtuous and pious as yours has nothing to fear, everything to hope and expect from the last of human evils.
The war continued in New England throughout the fall of 1775 as John and Abigail pressed for a full declaration of independence. But the March 1776 evacuation of the British Army from Boston and its movement southward raised the question of how the rest of the American colonies would respond to the military threat. Also, the prospect of a new national government sparked a debate between Abigail and John on women's rights.
March 31, 1776. I wish you would ever write me a letter half as long as I write you. And tell me, if you may, where your fleet are gone. What sort of defense Virginia can make against our common enemy? Whether it is so situated as to make an able defense? Are not the gentry lords and the common people vassals? Are they not like the uncivilized natives Britain represents us to be? I hope their riflemen, who have shown themselves very savage and even bloodthirsty, are not a specimen of the generality of the people. I have sometimes been ready to think that the passion for liberty, cannot be equally strong in the breasts of those who have been accustomed to deprive their fellow creatures of theirs. Of this I am certain, that it is not founded upon that generous and Christian principle of doing to others as we would that others should do unto us. I feel very differently at the approach of spring to what I did a month ago. We knew not then whether we should plant or sow with safety, whether when we had toiled, we would reap the fruits of our own industry, whether we could rest in our own cottages, or whether we should not be driven from the seacoast to seek shelter in the wilderness. But now we feel as if we might sit under our own vine and eat the good of the land. Though we felicitate ourselves, we sympathize with those who are trembling, lest the lot of Boston should be theirs. I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And by the way, in the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you remember the ladies. And be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. That your sex is naturally tyrannical is a truth so thoroughly established as to admit of no dispute. But such of you as wish to be happy willingly give up the harsh title of master for the more tender and endearing one of friend. Why then not put it out of the power of the vicious and the lawless to use us with cruelty and indignity with impunity? Men of sense in all ages abhor these customs, which treat us only as the vassals of your sex. Regard us then as beings, placed by Providence under your protection, and in imitation of the Supreme Being, make use of that power only for our happiness.
Philadelphia, April 14, 1776. You justly complain, You justly complain of my short letters, but the critical state of things and the multiplicity of avocations must plead my excuse. You ask where the fleet is. The enclosed papers will inform you. You ask what sort of defense Virginia can make. I believe they will make an able defense. Their militia and minutemen have been some time employed in training themselves, and they have 9 battalions of regulars, as they call them, maintained among them under good officers at the continental expense. The gentry are very rich, and the common people very poor. This inequality of property gives an aristocratic turn to all their proceedings, and occasions a strong aversion in their patricians to common sense. But the spirit of these barons is coming down, and it must submit. As to declarations of independency, be patient. As to your extraordinary code of laws, I cannot but laugh. We have been told that our struggle has loosened the bands of government everywhere, that children and apprentices were disobedient, that schools and colleges were grown turbulent, that Indians slighted their guardians and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. But your letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, were grown discontented. This is rather too coarse a compliment, but you are so saucy, I won't blot it out. Depend upon it, we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. Although they are in full force, you know they are little more than theory. We dare not exert our full power in its full latitude. We are obliged to go fair and softly, and in practice, you know we are the subjects. We have only the name of masters, and rather than give up this, which would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat, I hope General Washington and all our brave heroes would fight.
Abigail dropped the subject of women's rights for the time being. And both she and John celebrated when a Declaration of Independence was finally proclaimed in July. Abigail received the news in Boston, where she had gone with all of her children to be inoculated for smallpox.
Philadelphia, July 3rd, 1776. Yesterday, the greatest question was decided, whichever was debated in America. And a greater perhaps never was or will be decided among men. A resolution was passed without one dissenting colony that these united colonies are of right, ought to be, free and independent states, and as such they have, and of right ought to have, full power to make war, conclude peace, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which other states may rightfully do. You will see in a few days a declaration setting forth the causes which have impelled us to this mighty revolution, and the reasons which will justify it in the sight of God and man. A plan of confederation will be taken up in a few days. When I look back to the year 1761, which I have hitherto considered as the commencement of the controversy, I am surprised at the suddenness, as well as greatness, of this revolution. Britain has been filled with folly, and America with wisdom. At least this is my judgment. Time must determine. It may be the will of heaven that America shall suffer calamities still more wasting and distresses yet more dreadful. If this is to be the case, it will have this good effect at least. It will inspire us with many virtues which we have not, and correct many errors, follies, and vices which threaten to disturb, dishonor, and destroy us. But I must submit all my hopes and fears to an overruling providence in which, unfashionable as the faith may be, I firmly believe.
Boston, July 13, 1776. By yesterday's post, I received two letters dated the 3rd and 4th of July. And though your letters never fail to give me pleasure, be the subject what it will, yet it was greatly heightened by the prospect of the future happiness and glory of our country. Nor am I a little gratified when I reflect that a person so nearly connected with me has had the honor of being a principal actor in laying a foundation for its future greatness. May the foundation of our new Constitution be justice, truth, and righteousness. Like the wise man's house, may it be founded upon those rocks, and then neither storms or tempests will overthrow it. Boston, July 21st, 1776. Last Thursday, after hearing a very good sermon, I went with the multitude into King Street to hear the proclamation for independence read and proclaimed. The troops appeared under arms and all the inhabitants assembled there. When Colonel Crafts read from the balcony of the State House the proclamation, great attention was given to every word. As soon as he ended, the cry from the balcony was, "God save our American states," and then three cheers which rended the air. The bells rang. The privateers fired the forts and batteries. The cannon were discharged. The platoons followed, and every face appeared joyful. Mr. Bowdoin then gave a sentiment, "Stability and perpetuity to American independence." After dinner, the king's arms were taken down from the State House and every vestige of him from every place in which it appeared and burnt in King Street. Thus ends royal authority in this state, and all the people shall say, Amen.
John returned home briefly in the fall of 1776, but quickly returned to the Continental Congress. His absence in the spring and summer of 1777 was particularly difficult because Abigail was pregnant again with their sixth child.
Philadelphia, March 16, 1777. The spring advances very rapidly, and all nature will soon be clothed in her gayest robes. The green grass, which begins to show itself here and there, revives in my longing imagination my little farm and its dear inhabitants. What pleasures has not this vile war deprived me of? I want to wander in my meadows, to ramble over my mountains, and to sit in solitude or with her who has all my heart, by the side of the brooks. These beautiful scenes would contribute more to my happiness than the sublime ones which surround me.
Braintree, April 17th, 1777. Your obliging favors of March 14th, 16th, and 22nd have been received, and I most sincerely thank you for them. I know not how I should support an absence already tedious, and many times attended with melancholy reflections, if it was not for so frequently hearing from you. That is a consolation to me, though a cold comfort in a winter's night. As the summer advances, I have many anxieties, some of which I should not feel, or at least should find them greatly alleviated if you could be with me. But as that is a satisfaction I know I must not look for, though I have a good mind to hold you to your promise, since some particular circumstances were really upon that condition, I must summon all the philosophy I am mistress of, since what cannot be helped must be endured. I have enjoyed as much health since the smallpox as I have known in any year. Color and a clumsy figure make their appearance in so much that Master John says, "Mar, I never saw anybody grow so fat as you do."
Philadelphia, May 15th, 1777. General Warren writes me that my farm never looked better than when he last saw it, and that Mrs. Adams was like to outshine all the farmers. I wish I could see it. He knows the weakness of his friend's heart, and that nothing flatters it more than praises bestowed upon a certain lady. In the midst of infinite noise, hurry, and bustle, I lead a lonely, melancholy life, mourning the loss of all the charms of life, which are my family, and all the amusement that I ever had in life, which is my farm. However, I will neither whine nor croak. The moment our affairs are in a prosperous way, and a little more out of doubt, that moment I become a private gentleman, the respectful husband of the amiable Mrs. A. of Braintree, and the affectionate father of her children.
Braintree, July 9th, 1777. I sit down to write you this post, and from my present feelings, 'tis the last I shall be able to write for some time, if I should do well. I have been very unwell for this past week, with some complaints that have been new to me, though I hope not dangerous. I was last night taken with a shaking fit, and am very apprehensive that a life was lost, as I have no reason today to think otherwise. What may be the consequences to me, heaven only knows. I would not have you too much alarmed. I keep up some spirits yet, though I would have you prepared for any event that may happen.
Philadelphia, July 10th, 1777. My mind is again anxious, my heart in pain for my dearest friend. Oh, that I could be near to say a few kind words, or show a few kind looks, or do a few kind actions. Oh, that I could take from my dearest a share of her distress, or relieve her of the whole. Before this shall reach you, I hope you will be happy in the embraces of a daughter, as fair and good and wise and virtuous as the mother. Or if it is a son, I hope it will still resemble the mother in person, mind, and heart.
Braintree, July 16th, 1777. Join with me, my dearest friend, in gratitude to heaven that a life I know you value has been spared and carried through distress and danger, although the dear infant is numbered with its ancestors. My apprehensions with regard to it were well founded. Though my friends would have fain persuaded me that the vapors had taken hold of me, I was as perfectly sensible of its decease as I ever before was of its existence. It appeared to be a very fine babe, and as it never opened its eyes in this world, it looked as though they were only closed for sleep. My heart was much set upon a daughter. I had had a strong persuasion that my desire would be granted me. It was, but to show me the uncertainty of all sublunary enjoyments cut off ere I could call it mine.
John left the Continental Congress in November 1777, thinking to return to Massachusetts and resume his law practice. But Congress had other plans for him, diplomatic appointments, first to negotiate a treaty with France, then one with the Netherlands, finally to draw up the peace with Britain. All told, John would spend 10 years in Europe, with only a few short months at home in 1779. 11-year-old John Quincy Adams accompanied his father, gaining experience and an education that would serve him well in later years when he too was called to be an American diplomat in Europe. If Abigail had previously considered Philadelphia far away, the distance to Europe was almost unimaginable. The situation was made even more difficult by the unreliability of overseas mail. Letters were frequently lost, thrown overboard by captains evading capture by the British, or sunk in shipwrecks. Both the distance and duration of this separation, not surprisingly, put a strain on the Adamses' marriage.
November 12, 1778. I have taken up my pen again to relieve the anxiety of a heart too susceptible for its own repose. Nor can I help complaining to my dearest friend that his painful absence is not as formally alleviated by the tender tokens of his friendship. Three very short letters only have reached my hands during 9 months' absence. I cannot be so unjust to his affection as to suppose that he has not written much oftener, and more particularly, but must set down to the score of misfortune that so few have reached me. I cannot charge myself with any deficiency in this particular, as I have never let an opportunity slip without writing to you since we parted. Though you have no mention of having received a line from me, if they are become of so little importance as not to be worth noticing with your own hand, be so kind as to direct your secretary. I will not finish the sentence. My heart denies the justice of the accusation, nor does it believe your affection in the least diminished by distance or absence. But my soul is wounded as a separation from you, and my fortitude all dissolved in frailty and weakness. When I cast my thoughts across the Atlantic and view the distance, the dangers, the hazards which you have already passed through and to which you must probably be again exposed ere we shall meet, the time of your absence unlimited, all conspire to cast a gloom over my solitary hours and bereave me of all domestic facility.
Passy, France, December 18, 1778. This moment I had, what shall I say? The pleasure or the pain of your letter of the 25th of October. As a letter from my dearest friend, it gave me a pleasure that it would be in vain to attempt to describe. But the complaints in it gave me more pain than I can express. This is the third letter I have received in this complaining style. The former two I have not answered. I have endeavored to answer them. I have written several answers, but upon a review, they appeared to be such I could not send. One was angry, another was full of grief, and the third with melancholy, so that I burned them all. If you write me in this style, I shall leave off
writing entirely. It kills me. Can professions of esteem be wanting from me to you? Can protestation of affection be necessary? Can tokens of remembrance be desired? The very idea of this sickens me. Am I not wretched enough in this banishment without this? What course shall I take to convince you that my heart is warm? You doubt, it seems. Shall I declare it? Shall I swear to it? Would you doubt it the less? And is it possible you should doubt it? I know it is not. If I could once believe it possible, I cannot answer for the consequences. But I beg you would never more write to me in such a strain, for it really makes me unhappy.
Braintree, February 13th, 1779. My dearest friend, it is with double pleasure that I hold my pen this day to acquaint my friend that I have had a rich feast indeed by the Mifflin privateer, which arrived here on the 8th of this month and brought his letters of the 9th of September, 23rd of October, 2nd of November, and 2nd of December, altogether making more than I have received since your absence at one time. The handkerchiefs in which they were tied felt to me like a return of an absent friend. 'Tis natural to feel an affection for everything which belongs to those we love, and most so when the object is far, far distant from us. You chide me for my complaints when in reality I had so little occasion for them. I must entreat you to attribute it to the real cause, an over-anxious solitude to hear of your welfare, and an ill-grounded fear lest multiplicity of public cares and avocations might render you less attentive to your pen than I would wish. But bury, my dear sir, in oblivion every expression of complaint. Erase them from the letters which contain them, as I have from my mind every idea so contrary to that regard and affection you have ever manifested toward me.
During his years abroad, John achieved great diplomatic success, earning recognition of the United States by the Netherlands, securing a much-needed loan from the Dutch to keep the American government financially solvent, and negotiating a peace treaty with Britain. Once peace was achieved, he submitted his resignation to Congress and contemplated returning home, but then held off, hoping that he might be appointed minister to Great Britain. Abigail, tired of waiting after nearly 6 years apart, finally resolved in the spring of 1784 to join John in Europe. She and her daughter Nabby reached London in July.
London, July 23rd, 1784. My dearest friend, at length heaven be praised. I am with our daughter, safely landed upon the British shore after a passage of 30 days from Boston to the Downs. How often did I reflect during my voyage upon what I once heard you say, that no object in nature was more disagreeable than a lady at sea. It really reconciled me to the thought of being without you, for heaven be my witness, in no situation would I be willing to appear thus to you. I will add an observation of my own, that I think no inducement, less than that of coming to the tenderest of friends, could ever prevail with me to cross the ocean, nor do I ever wish to try it but once more. I was otherwise very sick, besides seasickness, but you must not expect to see me pined, for nothing less than death will carry away my flesh, though I do not think I ate more the whole passage than would have sufficed for 1 week. My fatigue is in some measure gone off, and every hour I am impatient to be with you.
The Hague, July 26, 1784. My dearest friend, your letter of the 23rd has made me the happiest man upon earth. I am 20 years younger than I was yesterday. It is a cruel mortification to me that I cannot go to meet you in London. Meantime, I send you a son who is the greatest traveler of his age, and without partiality, I think, as promising and manly a youth as is in the world. Every hour to me will be a day, but don't you hurry or fatigue or disquiet yourself upon the journey. Be careful of your health. After spending a week or two here, you will have to set out with me to France. But there are no seas between, a good road, a fine season, and we will make moderate journeys and see the curiosities of several cities in our way. It is the first time in Europe that I looked forward to a journey with pleasure.
John and Abigail spent the next 4 years together, first in France, then in London, while John served as minister to Britain. They exchanged only a handful of letters during those years and were never apart for more than a few weeks. Abigail greatly enjoyed Europe, reveling in the opportunity to travel and see the sights, but John found his position difficult at best. While King George III greeted him more cordially than John had ever expected, the British had little interest in diplomatic relations with their former colony. By early 1787, John had recognized the futility of his mission and submitted his resignation to Congress, though it would take another full year for John and Abigail to make arrangements to come home. The Adamses returned to Massachusetts in June 1788. Within the year, their life changed again when John was elected the first vice president under the new Constitution. He served 8 years in what he called the most insignificant office. During those years and later during the presidency, Abigail frequently returned to Quincy to oversee the farm and preserve her health. She preferred village life in Massachusetts to that in any of the three capital cities, first New York, then Philadelphia, then Washington, D.C. More than 500 of John and Abigail's letters survive from this period of their lives.
New York, May 14, 1789. My dearest friend, I have received yours of the 5th. If you think it best, leave Thomas at college, but I pray you come on with Charles as soon as possible. As to money to bear your expenses, you must, if you can, borrow of some friend enough to bring you here. If you cannot borrow enough, you must sell horses, oxen, sheep, cows, anything at any rate, rather than not come on. If no one will take the place, leave it to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. But at all events, break up that establishment and that household. I have as many difficulties here as you can have, public and private. But my life from my cradle has been a series of difficulties, and that series will continue to the grave.
Braintree, May 31st, 1789. My dearest friend, I hope to be able to relieve you soon of all domestic cares and anxieties. At least my best endeavors shall not be wanting. I know you want your own bed and pillows, your hot coffee, and your full portion of cayenne, where habit has become natural. How many of these little matters make up a large portion of our happiness and contentment, and the more of public cares and perplexities that you are surrounded with, the more necessary these alleviations. Our blessings are sometimes enhanced to us by the feeling, the want of them.
Even from Quincy, Abigail intently followed national and international events in the press, such as the war between Britain and France, in which the United States threatened to become embroiled, counting on John's letters to serve as her most reliable news source. She, in turn, became his trusted advisor and only confidant. As their children reached adulthood, John and Abigail faced new challenges and worries as parents. Nabby married the pompous and unsuccessful William Stephen Smith. Charles succumbed to alcoholism and died during his father's presidency. Thomas Boylston, the youngest, eked out a marginal legal career. Only John Quincy really shone. By 1794, he had gained a reputation like his father in law and politics, prompting President Washington to appoint him U.S. Minister to the Netherlands, the first in a long series of diplomatic missions that would culminate in him serving as the most noted Secretary of State in American history.
Quincy, April 18, 1794. My dearest friend, your letter of April 5th and 7th reached me last evening, and they fill me with more apprehensions of a war than anything I have before heard. The body of the people are decidedly against war, and if a war is madly or foolishly precipitated upon us without the union of the people, we shall neither find men or money to prosecute it, and the government will be cursed and abused for all the consequences which must follow. I have many disputes with your brother upon this subject, whose passions are up upon the insults and abuses offered us by Britain, and who is for fighting them instantly without seeing one difficulty in our way. In order to put a stop to too rash measures, Congress must rise. The people without are willing to wait the result of negotiation as far as I can learn, and in the meantime, we ought to prepare for the worst. I most devoutly pray that we may be preserved from the horrors of war and the machinations of man. I wish it were in our power to persuade all the nations into a calm and steady disposition of mind, while seeking particularly the quiet of our own country, and wishing for a total end of all the unhappy divisions of mankind by party split, which at best is but the madness of many for the gain of the few.
Philadelphia, May 19th, 1794. My dearest friend, the projects for war have been detected and exposed in every shape and under every disguise that has been given them, and hitherto defeated. What another year may bring forth, I know not. Mr. John, I hear, rises in his reputation at the bar, as well as in the esteem of his fellow citizens. His writings have given him a greater consideration in this place than he is aware of. I am sometimes told I ought to be proud of him, and truly I don't want to be told this. He will be made a politician too soon, but he is a man of great experience, and I hope sound philosophy. He was a greater statesman at 18 than some senators I have known at 50. But he must learn silence and reserve, prudence, caution, above all to curb his vanity and collect himself, faculties or virtues that his father has often much wanted. I have often thought he has more prudence at 27 than his father at 58.
In early 1796, Washington's decision not to run for a third term dramatically altered Abigail and John's lives. John became the heir apparent, and he and Abigail agonized over whether he should seek the presidency. George and Martha Washington had set high standards of Republican elegance and hospitality that Abigail feared she could not meet.
Philadelphia, January 5, 1796. My dearest friend, there is a dead calm in the political atmosphere which furnishes no event worth relating. I have this day, however, heard news that is of some importance. It must be kept a secret wholly to yourself. One of the ministry told me today that the president was solemnly and determined to serve no longer than the end of his present period. He mentioned such circumstances of solemn asseveration as left him no room to doubt. Mrs. Washington said one thing to me lately which seemed to imply as much. Others, men of the first weight, I find, consider the event as certain. You know the consequence of this to me and to yourself. Either we must enter upon ardors more trying than any ever yet experienced, or retire to Quincy, farmers for life. I am at least as determined not to serve under Jefferson as Washington is not to serve at all. I will not be frightened out of the public service, nor will I be disgraced in it.
Abigail remained in Quincy and congratulated John by letter on gaining the presidency on the day that the electoral vote was counted. She also did not attend the inauguration on March 4th, though John, of course, revealed his innermost anxieties to her.
Quincy, February 8th, 1797. My thoughts and my meditations are with you, though personally absent, and my petition to heaven are that the things which make for peace may not be hidden from your eyes. My feelings are not those of pride or ostentation upon the occasion. They are solemnized by a sense of the obligations, the important trusts, and numerous duties connected with it, that you may be enabled to discharge them with honor to yourself, with justice and impartiality to your country, and with satisfaction to this great people, shall be the daily prayer of your Abigail Adams.
Philadelphia, March 5, 1797. My dearest friend, your dearest friend never had a more trying day than yesterday. A solemn scene it was indeed, and it was made more affecting to me by the presence of General Washington, whose countenance was as serene and unclouded as the day. He seemed to me to enjoy a triumph over me. Methought I heard him think, I am fairly out, and you are fairly in. See which of us will be happiest. When the ceremony was over, he came and made me a visit and cordially congratulated me and wished my administration might be happy, successful, and honorable. I had not slept well the night before and did not sleep well the night after. I was unwell and I did not know whether I should get through or not. I did, however. How the business was received, I know not. Only I have been told that Mason, the treaty publisher, said we should lose nothing by the change, for he never heard such a speech in public in his life. All agree that, taken all together, it was the sublimest thing ever exhibited in America.
From time to time, John became maudlin and ruminated on whether his family had suffered too much from his lack of attention during the quarter century he contributed to the creation of the nation. Abigail pushed him to go forward without regret.
Philadelphia, December 17, 1798. My dearest friend, I begin to doubt whether I was in the way of my duty in ever engaging in public life. With my family of children, ought I not to have stayed at home, minded their education, and sought their advancement in life? It is too late for this chemistry now. The die is cast, and I am not far from the end of my life. I have done all for my children that I could and meant all for the best. What have I not suffered? What have I ever enjoyed? All my enjoyments have been upon my farm. Oh, that my children and grandchildren were all farmers.
Quincy, December 28, 1798. My dearest friend, the reflections and observations respecting our children calls up so many painful ideas that I cannot be otherwise than unhappy when I reflect upon them. In silence, I do reflect upon them daily. I wish it was otherwise with them. With respect to what is past, all was intended for the best, and you have the satisfaction of knowing that you have faithfully served your generation, that you have done it at the expense of all private considerations, and you do not know whether you would have been happier, a happier man in private than you have been in public life. The exigencies of the times were such as called you forth. You considered yourself as performing your duty. With these in considerations, I think you have not any cause for regret. What remains to us of life, we must expect to have checkered with good and evil. and let us patiently endure the one and rejoice in the other, as becomes those who have a better hope and brighter prospects beyond the grave.
John and Abigail spent the final years of John's presidency largely together, though John was alone for his first night in the newly built White House in Washington, D.C. His blessing on that house, written to Abigail, now graces the fireplace in the state dining room. Well before Congress had tallied the electoral count in February 1801, John knew he had lost his bid for re-election. Resigned to the end of his long public service, he prepared to clean up his final obligations, including filling various judicial vacancies. Abigail left Washington in mid-February. John waited until the morning of Thomas Jefferson's inauguration on March 4th. Their final letters to one another were written during Abigail's trip north. To the last, she monitored his political decisions.
President's House, Washington, D.C., November 2nd, 1800. My dearest friend, we arrived here last night, or rather yesterday at 1 o'clock, and here we dined and slept. The building is in a state to be habitable, and now we wish for your company. I shall say nothing of public affairs. I am very glad you consented to come on. It is fit and proper that you and I should retire together and not one before the other. Before I end my letter, I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof. Washington, February 16th, 1801. My dearest friend, the election will be decided this day in favor of Mr. Jefferson, as it is given out by good authority. The burden upon me in nominating judges and counsels and other officers, in delivering over the furniture, in the ordinary business at the close of a session, and in preparing for my journey of 500 miles through the mire, is and will be very heavy. My time will be taken up. I pray you continue to write me. My anxiety for you is a very distressing addition to all my other labors.
Philadelphia, February 21st, 1801. My dear sir, I shall leave this city tomorrow. I believe there is scarcely a lady who ever came to the drawing room but has visited me, either old or young, and very many gentlemen. As to a return of their visits, they cannot expect it. I believe they have made a point of it. Who published my arrival in the papers, I know not. But the next morning, by 10 o'clock, rainy as it was, they began to come and have continued it by the throngs ever since. I thank them for their attention and politeness, though I shall never see them again. Adieu, my dear friend. I wish you well through the remainder of your political journey. I want to see the list of the judges. In the years that followed John's election defeat and John and Abigail's return to Quincy, the Adamses continued to be active intellectually and socially. They exchanged no additional letters. There was no need to, as they were rarely separated for more than a few days. Their retirement years were not always easy. They had no income beyond what their farms produced, and they lost most of their savings from a bank failure in 1803. Fortunately, John Quincy had resources to help them maintain financial security. But that could not protect them from personal tragedy. Their beloved daughter, Nabby, passed away in 1814 after a lengthy battle with breast cancer. Abigail herself survived several illnesses, but continued to enjoy life in Quincy, especially when her children and grandchildren joined her. She and John remained pillars of the community. In the fall of 1818, however, she became dangerously sick with typhoid fever. On October 28th, in the early afternoon, she died. John was with her at the end. He wrote of her passing to his son, John Quincy.
Quincy, November 10th, 1818. My ever dear, ever affectionate, ever dutiful and deserving son, the bitterness of death is past. The grim specter so terrible to human nature has no sting left for me. My consolations are more than I can number. The separation cannot be so long as 20 separations heretofore. The pangs and the anguish have not been so great as when you and I embarked for France in 1778. The sympathy and benevolence of all the world has been such as I shall not live long enough to describe. I have not strength to do justice to individuals. Your letter of the 2nd is all, and no more than all that I expected. Never was a more dutiful son, never a more affectionate mother. Love to your wife. May you never experience her loss. So prays your aged and afflicted father.
John joined Abigail on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the American independence they had labored so long together and apart to create.